Hello, this is Rose Quizon Villazor, the interim co-dean of Rutgers Law School, and you are listening to The Power of Attorney. Today, I have the distinct honor of speaking with the Honorable Federal District Judge, Za Qureshi. Judge Qureshi is a 2000 graduate of Rutgers Law School. Judge, thank you so much for making time for me today.
No, thank you, Rose, for having me. And I presume I'll have to refer to you as Dean Quizon Villazor because I know this is a more formal podcast, but it's great seeing you even in a more formal setting. And thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you, Judge. So I'd like to start these conversations by asking the interviewee about their origin story. So tell me a little bit about your origin story. By this, you know, I want you to talk about, if you want, about your identity, what motivates you. So let's start there.
All right. Well, my identity, you know, it's interesting. So Dean, I think that in some ways that's a loaded question because it depends on kind of where the question is coming from. But look, I identify as an American. I was born in New York, raised in New Jersey. So I consider myself a Jersey guy, even though technically I was born in New York City and moved to New Jersey when I was a year old. But I'm also Pakistani American. My parents were born in Pakistan, so I'm first generation born in the United States, as you well know. I'm a father of two. I'm Muslim. So recently, I think folks have identified me by religion in a lot of ways. I think primarily based on my historical nomination when I became a district judge. And I'm also a veteran. So there's a bunch of different ways I identify depending on the focus of the question. But I did grow up in New Jersey from immigrant parents from Pakistan. And that really, I think, is the beginnings of, you know, who I am and why I am the way I am is really from them.
I think your response shows that there's a lot about you that connects with many different people. So for me, for example, I'm an immigrant. So then from that perspective, the connection with your parents as immigrants, that's important to me. And I think for many of our listeners are first-gen students, first-gen law school applicants, right, and first-gen alumni. And so there's that connection. I should have said this in the beginning. Judge, you know, it's for those who are listening, Judge Qureshi is the first Muslim-American federal district judge in the country. And before he became a federal district judge, he was a federal magistrate judge in New Jersey and became the first Asian-American judge to sit on the bench here in New Jersey. So there's a lot of firsts there that I'd like for us to explore later. But let me go back to your upbringing in New Jersey. Tell me about what it was like to grow up in New Jersey with immigrant parents.
So for me, I grew up, I don't know if you know the Union County area, but I grew up in Fanwood, New Jersey, which is a small town. In fact, it shares the same school district as Scotch Plains. So that's where I grew up. I will tell you, back in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, while I was growing up in the town, it was not as diverse as it is now. So there were very few folks that looked like my parents or me. In fact, the two other kids growing up, they were not Pakistani and they were not Muslim, right? So even though, you know, sometimes South Asians kind of get grouped together, I think we all know as we get older, there's significant differences by religion and by ethnicity. So for me, that was different, right? Growing up in a primarily white town in Fanwood, New Jersey. But, you know, my assimilation, it's interesting, and I don't know if we'll get into this, but one of my not really hobbies, I think I was very passionate about it as a child, was sports, specifically soccer. And the town I grew up in happened to be a quote unquote soccer town. And so I fell in love with this sport. And it really helped me to assimilate because through athletics and through being in a team sport, you made friends and you really ended up finding, I think, more focus on the similarities you had with other kids rather than the differences. And so, you know, even though I was the child at McDonald's getting the fish filet sandwich while my buddies were eating, you know, cheeseburgers and Big Macs, because that, when I was growing up, we would only eat halal. So my parents wouldn't let me, you know, try other things at McDonald's. You know, we didn't focus on those things because, well, we were all at McDonald's together. And we had this common interest in excelling in a sport that our community really cared about. And so for me, I think part of my upbringing and part of the lessons I've learned in life, you know, kind of winning with grace and also learning how to lose, those early lessons that are difficult for children to learn, I was able to learn a lot of that in that culture of soccer and playing sports on a team and being, I think, part of something larger than yourself, right? And so, but that was mostly my upbringing. I spent every season playing that sport. torturing my parents to let me travel outside of the state, sometimes outside of the country to play in tournaments. But they allowed me to do it. They knew that I really cared about it. I clearly was not good enough to play professionally or Division I soccer and gave it up. But I think if you asked a lot of folks about my childhood, that sport would take up a large part of it.
So since you brought up sports, this came up during lunch just earlier today. In many kids these days who are participants in sports, everyone gets a trophy, right? And so what was that? I mean, did you get a trophy all the time when you were growing up?
No. So I will tell you, I think the culture was a little bit different. And it's funny because I have two children, as you well know.
Yeah.
I'm a little tougher on them with some of these changes, I think, that I've seen in kind of the sport culture. But no, look, I will tell you that there were no participation trophies when I was growing up. You either would, you know, win first or second place, or you went home empty handed. And look, I will tell you that was difficult. I think I learned some hard lessons as a kid because not everything was given to you. You know, you could compete competitively. And when you're young and you're emotional and you're not mature enough to adjust to winning and losing, I can tell you that as a child, there were days where I'd walk off the field crying and I got second place. The team was in the finals. We won a trophy and we would be in tears because we didn't win. And I think, look, part of that is growing up and learning how to lose with grace and accepting that you're not perfect and that you have to learn to fail so that you can really appreciate your successes. But I think sometimes with my children, I have to step in to teach them those lessons. So when, you know, my son was playing baseball and their team was in second to last place and he got a trophy at the end of the season, I did not put that trophy on the mantle.
Josh, that's so mean.
I did not. I told him when he earns a trophy, we'll put it up in display, but this one can just go in a drawer. But so I might be a little bit tough on my kids because of my upbringing, but I will tell you, I thought that we learned very valuable lessons in life because as you get older, you know, accepting, you know, even in the legal profession, you know, even when you're in college, you know, not getting the grade that you thought you were entitled to, or maybe you get rejected from a job that you were hoping that you would get. A lot of those lessons on rejection and loss, I think you can learn at an earlier age. And for me, athletics was really the way I learned, I think, a lot of those kind of tougher life lessons when I was younger. And I think it really stayed with me when I was older, where I could accept, you know, accountability and failures and successes, I think, easier than maybe others who didn't grow up, you know, playing a sport competitively. So,
yeah, no, as a mother of two also with them who they didn't do a lot of sports, but they were definitely involved in other competitive, events. And it's hard because it's a different culture. And I always had to say, you know, it's okay to not be number one. It's part of our growth. And it's, you learn a lot from not winning this debate or for not getting the part that you wanted in this particular show, right? So I hear you, but it's hard in the classroom, certainly, you know, as you know, you were one of our professors at Rutgers Law School, and we assign the grades that we believe the students have earned, and there's some heartaches that come with that. Well, let me, I want to explore a little bit college life because you mentioned college. So I know you went to the John Jay College of Criminal Justice where you received a Bachelor of Arts. Why did you choose to go to John Jay College?
Yeah, so my father, who's no longer alive, but he was a significant influence to me, not only in my younger years, but as a young adult. And so I had an interest, I think, early on, as I remember it, in law enforcement. And my father, who was not a lawyer, he was a physician. He really didn't understand the legal profession. So I really had to kind of navigate, you know, all of this, whether it was criminal justice or law school or the legal profession, more on my own because it was foreign to him. But, you know, he had a lot of patients that were in law enforcement and he knew that John Jay had a very strong criminal justice program. And so he had recommended that I consider that school because he thought it might nurture this interest that I had. You know, when I was younger, like I said before, all I did was play soccer for so many years. Between the ages of 5 and 17, that took up a large portion of my life. And so to kind of give that up and reboot and to find a new interest, I think my father was trying to make sure that I gravitated to something that would encourage it. And so John Jay seemed like a natural school. It was in the area because I was from here. And so I went to school in Manhattan for 4 years. to gain my criminal justice degree. So that was the real catalyst, is that I had an interest in law enforcement, and this seemed like a good fit to kind of build off of that interest to see if this was really something that I should be pursuing.
I'm struck by the fact that you said your dad suggested John Jay College, and then you listened to him. It sounds like you and your dad had a good relationship.
Yeah, so we were close. I mean, I will tell you, as a teenager and as a younger kid, I'm sure I pushed the envelope a bit, like any other American kid growing up here, especially when you have immigrant parents, right? So they're struggling with two kind of cultural worlds clashing on a daily basis, right? And that's who I was, because I was completely Americanized when I was born here. And my parents, you know, really tried to build off of that. You know, they only spoke English in the home. They never spoke Urdu or any other dialect because they wanted to only speak English. They wanted to have me immersed in American culture, but that comes with some downsides. And so I obviously was a little bit of a rebellious teenager, but my father was always close, as my closest counselor, and I trusted him, you know, with a lot of important decisions. And it didn't mean that the decisions were not mine to make, but I always sought out his counsel, and that was one of them. In fact, we'll get to this, but you know, me ultimately not going into law enforcement immediately, but pursuing law school was also strongly suggested by my father, because I was doing well academically. And my father thought, why pursue a career in law enforcement right away? Why not see what other opportunities might be available, get an advanced degree in the law? And if law enforcement was still something I wanted to do, then by all means, pursue it. But you're young and you don't even know all the opportunities that are out there. So why not pursue a higher degree and keep those opportunities available to you? So he ultimately influenced me not to pursue a career in law enforcement immediately, but to apply to law school, which I did.
And lucky us.
That's history.
And lucky us, you ended up, you chose to come to Rutgers Law School. So now I'm going to ask you questions about that. And I'm sure some of your former students might be listening here to try to better understand you as a professor. So tell us about your experience at Rutgers Law School. What was it like? Tell me about orientation. You know, when you walked in, oh, you were at the other building, right?
I was at the old building, but yeah. I will tell you, my class, so I was the class of 2000, so that's going to age me a bit with anyone younger that might listen to this podcast, but my last semester in law school was in the new building. I will tell you, we resisted it. We were so used to the law school that we had, and if you were on journal, it was very private, it wasn't very open. There were all these little nooks and offices where students, you know, student-run organizations had the privacy they wanted. So we were opposed to moving to the new building and begged to graduate in the law school that we were in, even though, as we all know, the facilities in the new building are wonderful and it's great for the school and it's great for the student body. But, you know, we're creatures of habit. And so we resisted. But as the administration would tell you, we didn't have a choice. It's time to move over to the new building. And we did. So I started off, you know, down the street on Washington. But ultimately, I did graduate from the current law school that the students now attend. And look, for me, Rutgers offered me a lot of the opportunities I was looking for. First of all, it had a wonderful reputation as a law school at the time that I was applying, and it still does today. In fact, I think the reputation has been enhanced over time, and that's great. But it had a great reputation for a top-notch education in the law. It had a reasonable tuition because it was a state university, and it kept me in the area that I knew, even though I was not clear on what I was going to do with this law degree. Dean, it kept me in the New York, New Jersey area. And I was from Jersey and I wanted to be in this area. So it really offered me a great education at a top price and in an area that I wanted to be in. And so that kind of gravitated me to Rutgers. And that's ultimately why I applied and why I selected to go to law school. And to answer your question, first day of orientation, I mean, I'm at a loss, right? You know, I wish in hindsight, going from high school to college to law school is not ideal. And as an adjunct, when I teach, you always see the difference between folks that are, you know, they've been employed for a few years and then come into law school, or if you're teaching the weekend students who are going to law school part-time, you know, that level of maturity, that type of life experience, I didn't have. I was straight through. And so, look, my first year was a difficult transition in that you have to learn a lot. You have to rethink, you know, how you're thinking as a student, right? Because they're trying to teach you how to think like a lawyer, which is different than my college experience. But also part of it was, you know, college plus. So I met folks at orientation, friends that I would have for the next 3 years of law school and beyond. And to me, my experience at Rutgers was a very positive experience, which is why I think I'm committed to always come back. You know, when you ask me, hey, do you want to do the podcast? I don't know how many times I've even said no to Rutgers, but also equally to Seton Hall, since we have two New Jersey law schools. But, you know, I graduated from Rutgers. And so I think because of my positive experience, I'm always quick to return to see if I can do a little bit to add back, you know, some of that goodwill for the next generation. So,
and, you know, we appreciate it. I was vice dean when I needed professors to come teach trial skills classes. And those classes, we have a full-time faculty who teach those courses, but we don't have enough of them. And it's even more important for us to hire judges, lawyers, those in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I mean, really practitioners who can come to Rutgers and teach our students what it's really like to be in a trial or to do depositions, to do alternative dispute resolution. And so I remember reaching out to you saying, you know, would you be open to teaching for us? And you said yes. And then the pandemic happened. And then I said, well, so are you still interested in teaching? I get it. I understand if you don't want to. And you still said yes. And my students were so grateful to you because you gave them that experience. There was Zoom experience, and then there was an in-person experience. So thanks so much for doing that. And then you became federal district judge, so you didn't have as much time anymore. And as you know, whenever you want to come back, Judge, we'd love to have you.
I appreciate that. And look, for me, I will tell you, coming back to the school to teach trial presentation was, well, I'm not going to take credit, but the students should know. You know, two of my incoming law clerks were students of mine in my trial presentation class that did an outstanding job. And when they were looking for clerkships, and, you know, this is how the legal community operates. Maybe they didn't realize it, but they were on a 15-week interview without knowing it. And both of them were selected. And I won't put them on the spot and name them, but two of your students will be clerking for me at the end of August this year. And both of them were in my separate trial presentation classes. So, you know, not only is it an opportunity for me to give back to the school, but I think it exposes the student body to some of the judges. And you really don't know where those relationships will go. Sometimes they build, a mentorship type relationship where you end up continuing to have communication with the student. Sometimes you can end up getting a clerkship out of it. So they should probably thank you for bringing me on, but I thought it was worth noting that, you know, it was not only a positive experience for me to try to give back, but I got something in return. I got two outstanding law clerks that are going to start, you know, later this year that come out of Rutgers Law School and specifically out of my trial presentation class. So, mm-hmm. You know, I think if you have any students that are before any judges over there at Rutgers, you know, they should be mindful that you're on a 15-week interview. You have no idea if it's just about a grade or it could be about future employment. And I would, you know, strongly encourage them to give it everything they've got and to put into that class what they would, you know, put into any full-time or part-time class, because you just don't know where it might lead.
All right. Well, so, and yes, I'm really excited about for those students. I'd like to know what you were like as a student. So when you were, what was your favorite class?
You know, it's interesting. If I say it now, you're going to say no way. But I really loved legal research and writing. So I think everyone finds their own area that not only do they have strengths in, but, you know, you end up gravitating, I think, to areas that you're stronger in, right? Because you're successful and you feel good about the product. And for me, I really loved my legal research and writing class. I ended up doing well. I ended up becoming a TA in my third year to give back to that class, you know, assigned to a professor. I worked for my legal research and writing professor as a 1L, you know, my 1L summer job to make some money. Mm-hmm. And that also led me to, you know, do a write-on to get onto the Computer and Tech Law Journal. I did the write-on in my first year where I was selected to the Moot Court Board. And so for me, you know, I think in hindsight, I appreciate how much that did for me, right? That I was interested in that area. And so, you know, you end up building on those writing and research skills. And later on, when you're looking for employment, a lot of folks will look to that area to see, well, what were you doing in legal research and writing? Were you honing those skills? Were you doing things at law school to advance that? But that's kind of where the area, I think the area that I enjoyed the most, even though it was painful, right? And it was stressful at times, you know, writing briefs, especially when this was all fairly new to us as law students. But I always encourage students at Rutgers that if they ask me, you know, what else can I do? And I said, take advantage of the opportunities at the school. I mean, one is a lot of legal research and writing, whether it's journal or Moot Court Board or taking an advocacy course. But the other is the clinics. I mean, the public service, I think, that Rutgers promotes with its student body is second to none. And I think it really gives students an opportunity to understand, well, what are all the different things that you can do with a law degree rather than just you get a law degree, you go to a law firm. And I don't discourage that. I think that's one avenue for the students at Rutgers, but it's definitely not the only one. And I think Rutgers does a very good job of exposing the student body to a variety of different opportunities so that they can choose what's the best fit for them. So, but that was my area. And I had a very positive experience with my student, like when I was a student at Rutgers, and just the friendships that I made along the way. And I think that's part of what gravitates me back to the school.
And then what about, were there any classes that you didn't like? I teach property law, but I hated property law in law school. I could not stand it. It wasn't until my third year when I did landlord-tenant clinic that I realized, gosh, property law is so important. Right. And so, but I remember hating property, and it was a year-long course for me in my 1L year.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a class I hated necessarily. I mean, look, in your first year, it's a curriculum, right? You're not really, you have no discretion on what course you take. I will say this, though. I gravitated more towards, you know, constitutional law and criminal law because I found them more interesting. And some of the case law was a little more sexy and exciting to read than, say, some of the contract cases, some of the torts cases. But I don't think I hated any class, but I think every student, you know, I think gravitates to a particular area of interest. And for some people, it might be contracts, it might be torts, and it might be property. So I wouldn't want to kind of influence that in any way. But I think for me, it was more criminal law and constitutional law. And even at the time that I found it interesting, I still had no idea what I was going to be doing with my career until well after I graduated law school. But I think in hindsight, those were the areas I found more appealing to me. If that makes sense.
All right. Well, that's fair. So you graduated in 2000, which actually, by the way, is the year I graduated also from law school. So we're both old or young, depending on who you're talking to, right? And so after you graduated, you clerked for the New Jersey Supreme Court Judge Edwin Stern.
Yes.
What kind of cases did he handle and what kind of issues did you work on?
Sure. So just briefly, Judge Stern was in the appellate division when I clerked for him. He was elevated to the Supreme Court later when I think there was a vacancy and he was the presiding judge of the appellate division, but that was after my time that I clerked for him. But I'll make one note just because I think this is also important and I might as well say, I interned my 1L summer for Judge Stern. And what I ended up doing is the law clerk at the time who was with him, you know, was like requiring no less than 4 days in chambers. And I also wanted to work for my legal research and writing professor, as I mentioned. So I did both those jobs. But let me tell you, I think it's important for students to know this because I've spoken about this before. That summer internship that was for free, that 4 days a week where I busted my hump, ultimately led me to a clerkship because in my second year, I wanted to bend the ear of Judge Stern to get his guidance on a few things. One, where he thought I might want to apply, and two, whether he thought the clerkship would be worthwhile based on kind of what I'd been doing and where I was going. And I remember meeting with him and he ended up saying to me, "So do you want the job?" And I said, "I'm sorry, what?" And he says, "Zai, I've known you. You worked for me for an entire summer. You broke your butt 4 days a week. Do you want to come clerk for me?" And I said, "If that's a legitimate offer, I'll accept it right here and now." And that's how I ended up getting my clerkship for
that's
after.
That's amazing.
Right? So
yeah.
I will tell you that experience I just want to mention because I think it's important about, well, how did you even get that clerkship? And, you know, sometimes doing these, you know, some people think, well, I'm working for free and I'm not being paid. I tell everyone, you treat that job like you're getting paid $3,000 a week because you got to have pride in your work and you also don't know where it's going to lead and you want to build your reputation. And that reputation starts in law school. It doesn't begin 10 years out, right? You start building a reputation for who you are and what type of work product you're going to deliver and how you're going to be when no one's watching, right? All those things. That reputation is built in law school. You don't wait till you graduate. So I just want to make that note, Dean, because I think it's important for folks to know how I got it. The other thing I'll say is Judge Stern was just a tremendous human being. So he was unbelievably kind as a judge. You know, talk about judicial temperament. Just unbelievably nice to everybody. But he was also brilliant. I mean, he literally could pull a reporter off the shelf. Say, you need to look at 32 NJ-186. Which was the pinpoint page for a Supreme Court case in New Jersey that was on point for an issue that I would be dealing with. And so he had that type of mind, but he was also very kind to everyone that worked with him and everybody in the courthouse. And I will tell you, it was my first exposure to the judiciary, right? As a 1L summer in college, I never did anything with the court system. This was my first exposure. It taught me, I think, a lot about, and at the time I didn't know I wanted to be a judge, but when I think about it now as a judge, what kind of judge, you know, do you want to be? How do you want to be with the folks that are around you? And constantly trying to learn and improve. You know, he educated himself. He didn't memorize those cases because he had a photographic memory. He would constantly read and be educated. But I will tell you, it was a wonderful experience. I may be biased, but I always strongly encourage students to consider clerkships, judicial clerkships, whether at the state trial level, appellate or Supreme Court, or even the federal trial or appellate level, because I think it's a unique opportunity that you can't always get. And it's early in your career, but I also appreciate financial restrictions. And some people may not be able to afford to do that for a year or so after law school. But if you can, all things being equal, I strongly encourage students to consider the opportunity because you not only get a nice experience of kind of unveiling the kind of the demystifying the process, right, of working in the court system, you can have a mentor for life. You know, Judge Stern, I've known my entire career, and it's been very, I think, a positive experience for me to have a judge in my corner to bounce ideas off of, to get advice, and all the rest of it. So I put that out there for your clerkship folks that, you know, unless there's a real reason not to do it, you know, I would strongly consider they think about it. We just did a panel recently at Rutgers, as you know, with Justice Rabner and some other folks from the state judiciary. And also I was there from the federal judiciary to talk about the positive experience and what we think, you know, a clerkship could bring to the table. And it was well attended. And I appreciate Rutgers putting that together because I thought it was an important message for the students.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you on that, that I clerked after law school and it was the best job I've had. To this day, I'm really good friends with my judge. I go to him for advice on anything because the judge just looks out for you. He's no agenda. If I want an honest answer about an issue and or how I should you know, answer a question on a personal level with respect to future jobs and other issues. He's always there to just listen and guide me.
Yep.
And that's what you get. You know, that's part of what you get from a, like as you're saying, from a clerkship. It's a lifelong mentorship relationship with this judge.
Yep. So, and it's an intense relationship, right? I mean, you're working with a judge for at least a year, like pretty much every day, interacting with the judge, you know, often. So look, it's a close relationship. I encourage it, but at the same time, I think part of the reason why I encourage it is now that I'm a judge, I still remember what my experience was like, as you do, right? Mm-hmm. As a law clerk and how positive that was for us. So, but I put that out there just because I think it's important.
Yeah. So then after you clerked, you decided you went into private practice, but then somewhere, you didn't stay there very long because then you decided to join the military.
Right. I started at LaBeouf Lambert & McRae on September 11, 2001. So everybody knows in our, you know, generation where we were on September 11th. I was filling out, you know, direct deposit forms and signing policies for LaBeouf Lambert & McRae. And look, I went to that firm. It was the firm no longer exists, but it was a very prestigious law firm at the time. And I didn't know exactly what I was going to do with my law degree. So I thought, you know, the clerkship and then going to a very large law firm seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, I was going to be making a significant amount of money. I was shocked at, you know, kind of what the salaries were back in 2000. Now I'm shocked when I see what my law clerks make. But look, it was a good opportunity. I didn't know exactly what I would do. But I will tell you, I think that day had a tremendous impact on me, not just because as an American, we were attacked on September 11th, but I'm a Muslim American too. And I think, you know, the aftermath of 9/11, you know, triggered, I think, something in me that I was going to go serve. And so in 2002, I applied to the U.S. Army JAG Corps. And in 2003, I was accepted into the Officer Basic Corps. So I probably was at LaBeouf, Lamb, Green & McRae no more than a year and a half. But already within a year, I'd applied to the Army, and then it took a little longer for me to get in the OBC, the Officer Basic Corps. So that was the reason why. I think people, when they first looked at my resume later, they would say, oh, you went to law school, then the Army, then you clerked. And I said, no, I was at law school, Then I clerked, then I went to LaBeouf, then I left for the Army. And I think when they hear that, they always want to ask me about it. But that was the order, and that's why I ended up leaving. But it changed the trajectory of my entire career and my life, because my time in the military, which would take too long to cover in this podcast, had a significant impact on me. And when I left the military, when I was honorably discharged, I wanted to remain in public service and continue to serve my country as a civilian. So it ended up really changing the trajectory of my legal career, and I think me personally in a way. Mm-hmm. So it was very important to me. But yep, that's where I went after LaBeouf.
We have a lot of students here who are veterans or still actively serving. And I'm always, I have such deep admiration for the kind of work that service men and women do. In general, and but then also while they're in law school. And you said that your time in the military made an impact, and can you just share maybe one story or one an issue that you dealt with at the time that affected the trajectory of your career?
Yeah, sure. So I just so I'm clear, I was a military judge advocate, right? Which really means you're a military lawyer. So my primary job was advising commanders on a variety of legal issues. So I was stationed in Germany, which was already a unique experience. I was stationed overseas, and I deployed to Iraq in Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2004, and then a second time in 2006. So I had experience in a war zone as well, but in the role of a lawyer, a military lawyer. So for me, that I just want to put that, because I wasn't an infantryman. I advised commanders of combat arms, commanders like infantry commanders, battalion commanders, brigade commander, but I was not one myself. For me, I think the greatest impact, and I've spoken about this publicly, is, first of all, how I was received in the military. And I think that's important to note, because you have to understand that after 9/11, right, I'm a Pakistani American. My parents were not born here. I'm Muslim, and I'm now going to go serve in the Army. And how is that going to be received? And somebody with my name and my face, is anyone going to even want to work with me? Are they going to trust me? Magnify that by just a few months prior to me entering the officer basic course, a Muslim American soldier commits the most tragic of crimes and kills other American soldiers in Kuwait by throwing a grenade into tents with the 101st Airborne. And I won't give him credit by even naming him, but a simple Google search will bring up this case. And so immediately prior to me joining the officer basic course, somebody who looks like me with a name like mine just killed American soldiers and was in an American uniform. So for me, look, there was some hesitancy when I was about to embark on this new journey. And look, I will tell you, I basically had to just mentally prepare that this might be a very difficult 4 years. At the time, my commitment was actually 3 years. I extended an additional year to deploy a second time. But so I guess initially it'd be a very difficult 3 years. And it may be one of the most hostile work environments I've ever encountered or will ever encounter in my life. And what I think is important, Dean, is to say up front, nothing could have been farther from the truth. Mm-hmm. I met just unbelievably great Americans when I was serving in the Army. And I was accepted, and I was able to do my job effectively. And I had the ear of the commanders, and I had the respect of the soldiers. And this idea, this notion that I would be ostracized or that I wouldn't be trusted, never came to fruition. And I'm very appreciative of that experience, because it really was not necessarily what I expected, even though I really thought it was important for me to serve. And I was going to do it, you know, come hell or high water, whether it was going to be positive or negative, this is what I was going to do. But it's so positive that to this day, I still continue to speak at military events. I speak to young judge advocates. I was at the Pentagon a month or so ago speaking there. I was at Fort Bragg speaking there. On Veterans Day, I flew to Georgia Law School to speak there on Veterans Day. And to me, I'm very proud that on Veterans Day, a law school would have me as the face of the veteran to speak about military, right? And what, you know, there might years ago, that might not have been the case. And so I'm very proud to speak on those issues. But that to me, I think, is the most important thing I can say about my experience. But of course, look, I was advising on, it depends. When I first started off, I was assisting soldiers with legal issues. When I was in Iraq the first time, we would deal with the rules of engagement and other areas of the law of war, because we were in Iraq. When I was deployed a second time, we would review evidence of detainees, and I would advise commanders on whether we had sufficient evidence or not. I would advise soldiers on what type of evidence to collect. I've even been on missions with infantry soldiers who were going to be detaining a target, where I would assist on evidence collection at the location before we would depart. So there's a lot of, I think, different things I did. All I will tell you is a very small part. You know, my contribution to the military, I think, was very small. But for me, it was so significant that I could play any role to help American soldiers that were in a very, I think, difficult situation in a time of war. So I hope that answers your question. I want to talk a little bit about the positive experience, a little bit about what I did. But really, it was a very small percentage, but I was very proud of the time that I served. I served 4 years on active duty before I was honorably discharged. And then, like I said, it really was the catalyst to me looking for some civilian equivalent. You know, I really might have stayed in the military longer, but for my daughter being born in Germany. And that changed the, you know, I think my career path in a lot of ways with, you know, her mother, and I really wanted to bring her home, you know, and not have her moving from location to location. And I'd already deployed, you know, two times in my 4 years. So I could imagine what my deployment schedule would have been if I stayed in longer, and I wanted to spend time with her. So that was a major factor in me leaving the military.
Got it. So there's the other part of you, your identity as a father coming through that answer. So you left, you finished your service, and then, but you continued to do public service work. You worked for the Department of Homeland Security and then the U.S. Attorney's Office. Can you share a little bit about some of the work that you did while as an assistant U.S. attorney?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, because my time in the Department of Homeland Security was very short. I'll be honest, I wanted to be an assistant U.S. attorney when I came out of the military. It was, to me, part of the civilian equivalent of what I was doing in the military, right? I could continue to serve as a prosecutor, which, by the way, for two of my 4 years when I was in Germany, I was a military prosecutor. So I had some experience. The military rules of evidence mimic the federal rules of evidence. And I thought it was another way to serve my country, but as a civilian. And so I applied to the U.S. Attorney's Office. While I was going through that process, I did work at the Department of Homeland Security in immigration court on political asylum cases. So newbies in DHS, you know, really get those types of cases where people are applying for political asylum. And you're there to just make sure that there's no fraud component to the application, that it's legitimate. And you appear in immigration court, and ultimately the judge will decide if the asylum is granted. So I did that for about 8 months and then transferred to the U.S. Attorney's Office. At the U.S. Attorney's Office, I did a few different things. I started off in the government fraud section, you know, dealing really with fraud cases against the government. I worked in the narcotics unit briefly. And then the majority of my time at the U.S. Attorney's Office, I was in what's called the Special Prosecutions Division, which really deals with corruption, whether it's by law enforcement, politicians, or public workers. We dealt with investigating and prosecuting corruption within the government. And that was the division I wanted to be in. And I was fortunate that I was ultimately allowed to do that type of work. I will tell you, when you Google me, nobody talks about those types of civil rights cases. They always say, you know, oh, Judge Qureshi, you know, he's silent on civil rights. And all we know is he was a federal prosecutor. But if I think they dove in a little deeper, they would see that the majority of my time as a prosecutor, I was dealing with civil rights cases, because you're investigating and prosecuting corrupt law enforcement officers or corrupt politicians or the corrupt welfare caseworker who's extorting the welfare recipient. You know, I remember there was no case too small. You know, think about that when you ask about, well, what type of work? This is just an example, but, you know, I dealt with some pretty high profile public corruption cases, you know, that you could read about. But I also remember the cases that you'll never read about, you know, the welfare caseworker who's extorting $100 or $200 from the most vulnerable of our citizens, right? Those that are indigent and poor and that are eligible for welfare. But in order for them to stay on the program, somebody's extorting them to give some of that money to them based on nothing other than greed. Uh-huh. Those cases would aggravate me. And I would take that case just as seriously as the most high profile public official that we might be prosecuting, because those cases are not different, right? There are victims in those cases. And in some ways, I think the welfare recipient was a more vulnerable victim in some ways. So I think that was important work. I was very proud of the work I did at the U.S. Attorney's Office. But not everyone mentions, you know, what type of work I did. They think I was just a prosecutor dealing with, you know, guns and drugs. And that's not true. I did prosecute those cases. But the U.S. Attorney's Office also manages other prosecutions other than firearms and narcotics. And so I thought it was important to note that.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad that you did. And if we had more time, I would be asking more questions about those. But I ultimately want to start talking about your current position as a federal district judge. But pit stop at Reiser Danzig, you were there for several years. What was the motivation behind switching to moving back to private practice?
Sure. And I'll try to be brief so we can get to the judiciary because I know you want to. But look, part of my reasoning is I had been in public service for a long time with the U.S. Attorney's Office, Homeland Security, and the Army. So there were some financial, circumstances that I was concerned about. I had a second child by that point. My son, Aiden, you know, was there. And so I didn't just have my daughter, Zoe. And so I thought that this might be the time to transition. And also I had an interest in doing defense work. So for me, one of the conditions that I placed on Reiger Danzig, and they were willing to accept it, is that if I was going to join the firm, I also wanted to represent indigent defendants in federal court, those who could not afford my fees at a large New Jersey law firm, but that the court could appoint me if I was qualified on the list. And I was very appreciative. The law firm did not balk at that. They said, we're happy for you to do that type of work. But obviously, you know, it's a business. And so I have to do, you know, work with retained clients, and I was happy to do both. And so for me, it was not just the financial reasons of maybe developing a little bit more financially for my two children, but it gave me an opportunity to go on the other side. And I will tell you, I've never been a prosecutor at heart or a defense attorney at heart. I will tell you, at the heart of who I am, I've always believed in the system. And I think you need competent lawyers on both sides. And so, you know, if you told me one day someone was going to drag my mother out of her house, I would hope that she had excellent attorney representing her. And so for me, it was very important to be on the other side where I would actually battle the very office I came from, the U.S. Attorney's Office. So that's primarily what I was doing, white collar criminal defense, government investigations. But it wasn't all white collar criminal defense because I was doing court appointed cases. And as you know, many of those indigent defendants are parts of underrepresented groups. Blacks and Hispanics, and they're also primarily in blue-collar crime. So I was able to get involved on the defense side with those cases, and I was very happy to do it. And candidly, as a judge now, who presides over not only civil but criminal cases in federal court, I find that having that perspective of being a prosecutor but also a defense attorney, and not only a defense attorney, but a defense attorney who had to deal with clients who were retained, right? And the issues that come with that type of a client, but also indigent clients who I was appointed to represent and the issues that come up with those cases and those clients. I think that's helped me to be a little bit more balanced now that I'm presiding over the very cases I used to appear on, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think that through the different work that you've done, military, as a law clerk yourself, and then through public service, private practice, you have a diverse experience and viewpoints, I think, that exposure to different types of issues and people, where they're coming from, that I would think is shaping the way you are, how you are as a judge. So in 2019, you were appointed to become a federal magistrate judge. And then in 2021, you were then nominated to be on the district court and confirmed by the Senate. There's a lot of, I want to start off by talking about the firsts. There's so many firsts. When you hear, I've attended.
I can't wait till I never have to talk about it again. But hopefully that time will come sooner rather than later.
Yes, yes. We hope, you know, I hope so too. Like, I've been at these different events where you're, you know, you've been honored and you're the first Asian American federal judge in New Jersey, first Muslim American federal judge in the United States. What are your thoughts about, you know, when you're described as the first? You know, what comes to your mind or how do you feel about that?
I mean, look, I appreciate what it means. I will tell you, though, just at the outset, when I was applying to be United States Magistrate Judge, I was never applying with the goal of being the first anything. I really wanted to be a member of this court. I had appeared before the federal judges in our district for several years. I had a tremendous amount of respect for them in the court. And it had dawned on me, I think I want to do that. I want to do this, you know, and the hesitation of, well, why would I have a shot, right? Because as you know, magistrate judges, it's not political. They're selected by the district judges, right? The Article III judges choose who get to serve on the court with them as magistrate judges. And I think, you know, just having, you know, and it goes back to not courage, but maybe the audacity to apply and say, why not me? Why can't it be me? Even though there's nobody like me on this court ever, I think was the first hurdle that I needed to overcome, which I did. So I applied in 2019, and not only did I get on, but, you know, two Asian Americans got on the same year. So Judge Sun Keel, who's Korean American, was selected shortly thereafter in 2019 as the second Asian American on the court and as a magistrate judge. So 2019 was a big year for our federal court, New Jersey, for the Asian American legal community, I think, because both of us are on. So, but I will tell you, that's not how we think when we're applying. We're applying because we want a particular job. But I would be lying if I didn't say I appreciate what that means. Of course I do. Because, you know, look, one, you're under a microscope. If you're the first at anything, especially when you're in an underrepresented group, all eyes are on you. And so it matters kind of what you do and how you do it, because what you're looking to do is not shut the faucet off. You're looking to open the door for others to follow and then surpass you. And so I hope that both me and Judge Keel have done that. We are very fortunate that Judge Singh ended up, when I became a district judge, my vacancy at the magistrate judge level opened up. And I feel very proud that I was part of the district judges that selected Judge Roxana Singh to join the bench. She's the first female Asian American on the federal court in New Jersey. And I think she's the only female Muslim federal judge in the country, because there are other Muslim magistrate judges, but they're all male. She's the only female. So it's fairly significant that she's on the court. But I do feel proud that someone other who's highly qualified that was supposed to get the job got it. But that was the understanding when I applied, was I really wanted to do this work. But I'm not naive. And I think, you know, I appreciate what it means to be the first. And I think I understand what it means for the next generation. And I try to spend time speaking about these issues to motivate the next generation, not necessarily to follow us, but to surpass what we've already done. You know, I'm looking for the next Asian American. You know, now we finally have one on the Third Circuit, but it took some time, right? That only happened this past year. No Asian American had ever sat on our circuit court. No Asian American has ever sat on the U.S. Supreme Court. And what I think is relevant to Rutgers and New Jersey is no Asian American has ever sat on our state's highest court, the New Jersey Supreme Court. So there is a lot of work to do. And I don't look at the glass half empty. I look at it half full, but that doesn't mean that I don't have my foot on the gas at full throttle saying we need to do more and we need to do better. And I know that you believe the same thing, that we need to be vigilant and identify qualified candidates, but we also need to instill and encourage qualified candidates to be interested in public service and not be barred by, well, they're never going to pick me because nobody like me has ever gotten a job. Because if we all think like that, me and Judge Keel don't get on the bench, right? In order to get there, you have to put yourself on the chopping block to be rejected, right? You have to put yourself out there to be exposed where somebody will write an article about you. And I know that's difficult and it's not for everybody, but I think it's important for us to continue to push qualified candidates in every demographic, not just Asian American, but other represented groups to join the judiciary, to join other places where we don't have as strong as a voice. So that was the process in 2019, but I'm grateful that they selected me. And obviously in 2021, things changed again. And my job changed.
So many of our students or listeners don't really fully understand the work that federal magistrate judges do and district judges. Can you talk about what you did as a magistrate judge and then now what you do as a district judge?
Sure. So it's twofold, right? Because unlike state court, we're not broken up into divisions. So we have all civil and all criminal cases on the federal level come to us, right? I'm not a criminal district judge and nobody's a civil magistrate judge. It's everything that comes to the federal court. So magistrate judges on the civil side, right, that do, at least for the civil work that they get, primarily do the case management. And they work the case from beginning until dispositive motion. So all the discovery disputes on those civil cases, they address. But anything that's dispositive, so like a motion for summary judgment, a motion to dismiss, that would decide the case, those issues go to the district judge. Now, there's one exception in civil. The parties on civil cases can consent to magistrate judge jurisdiction. If they do that, the magistrate judge, for all intents and purposes, becomes the district judge on the case, can handle it dispositively, can even do the civil trial. In our district, we have excellent magistrate judges. So parties will consent to their jurisdiction on the civil side. And so you'll see magistrate judges dealing with case management. And in addition to that, they've taken over cases where they are the district judge. And so really it's twofold. On the criminal side, it's a little bit different. You can't consent to a magistrate judge on felony criminal cases. So every felony case that's charged in federal court has to be dealt with by a district judge. It cannot be assigned to them. So misdemeanor cases, cases that really, I would say, generally are defined by a sentence of, you know, a year or less, those can be handled by magistrate judges. But any felony case really has to be handled by district judges. So on the criminal side, the magistrate judges aren't dealing with the trials and they're not dealing with dispositive issues, but they are dealing with very important things. First of all, they're the first face you're going to see on a criminal case because they do the initial appearance and they determine bail, right? Whether somebody is going to be released pending their case or they need to be detained. And they primarily look at two factors without going into great detail, whether, you know, the defendant is a danger to the community or a flight risk. So magistrate judges have significant authority in criminal cases at the outset of those cases because they decide whether someone's going to be in prison who's presumed innocent, but pending their case has to be detained. And that's a significant responsibility. The one last thing I'll talk about, even though you don't see it in the face of the courtroom, but it's very important to magistrate judges, they're the gatekeepers of the Fourth Amendment. Every search warrant, everybody who has authority to go in your home to search your house or to arrest or to do those things that infringe on the Fourth Amendment and those constitutional issues, those applications are decided by magistrate judges. So they are the gatekeeper to the Fourth Amendment. They are deciding, you know, when the government can go into somebody's home to search and whether they have probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and if there's probable cause and evidence of that crime is in that location. So to be honest, that's a significant amount of power that a lot of folks don't talk about when they refer to magistrate judges. But you've seen some high profile cases now on TV and in the country where a magistrate judge can authorize a search warrant of a president's home. So think about the significance of that. An Article III judge is not doing that. An appointed magistrate judge is making that call. And so it's a very important job. It's one that we take seriously when we select. And it's one that I am unbelievably proud of that I was selected to. You know, sometimes people ask me, you know, now that you're a district judge, you know, how is that different? I'm most proud of being selected as a magistrate judge, but I do appreciate the challenges and the work that I get to do as a district judge that I that I do now. So hopefully that answers more of the magistrate judge question, but I don't know if you have more on the DJ.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was helpful. What do you find is the most challenging part of your job now as a judge?
So that I've had time to think about, and I think about it often because it is still the most challenging part of my job as a district judge, and that's sentencing. So as a prosecutor and as a defense attorney, I will tell you, I had a very great appreciation for the impact of a sentence on a defendant, whether I was prosecuting someone or representing that person in court. But it's a significant amount of weight on me when you are the ultimate decision maker on what sentence is appropriate for a criminal defendant. And not that that means that a term of incarceration is not appropriate. It is. And sometimes you have to sentence somebody to prison. But I appreciate the impact it has on family, on children, on people that are innocent, that are unrelated to the criminal conduct. And so I will tell you that as complex as some of the civil cases are, and having to learn a lot of different areas of law, and I can talk about that as a secondary challenge. But Dean, the primary challenge and most difficult part of the job, and you almost never feel good when you walk out of the courtroom after a sentencing hearing. I spend time kind of away from folks in my chambers after a sentencing and clear my head because I think it's the most difficult and challenging job of serving as a trial court judge and as a district judge. But I also think it's important. I trust myself to do it. And I will tell you, if I ever feel it's not challenging and that it's easy, it's probably a signal that I need to leave the bench because I think it should always be a difficult thing for judges to have to do because you are, even if you're issuing what you believe is an appropriate sentence and the right sentence for a particular case, lives are being destroyed in the process. And some of those lives are completely innocent to the criminal conduct and it's difficult.
That was really helpful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Well, we're at the top of the hour now. And so, we started off talking about you were a soccer player and then soccer player. Then well, you went
I might well plug in. You know, we had 3 state championships in 4. Okay. We were a highly successful soccer team when we became teenagers in high school.
Hey, that's great. And, you know, I watched Ted Lasso, so I'm learning a little bit more. And I'm just not a sports person. But yes, obviously, soccer is an important sport worldwide. And you played that. And then you went to law school, college law school. And then throughout your career, you know, I just want to say we're so proud of you at Rutgers Law School. You really are. You're a role model. You're inspiration to many of us here. Your former professors are so proud of you. Our students look up to you, and we're grateful to you for your ongoing support at the law school. So I just want to thank you for your commitment and your generosity to the law school and to the university. So thanks so much. And thank you for making time for us today.
No, thank you, Dee. Thanks for having me. And look, none of this happens without my legal career starting at Rutgers. And I know, you know, this, we said this at the outset, and I spoke about this earlier on this podcast, but one of the reasons why I gravitate back to the law school often and as much as I can is because of what it's done for me. I mean, my legal career started, you know, within the walls of Rutgers Law School in Newark. And for me, everything that follows, that was really the catalyst to get me to where I am today. So I'm happy to be a part of this. I hope some folks find it interesting, but please let me know how I can return. And I'm happy to be back there to see you and the student body and encourage the next generation of Rutgers Law students to continue where you and I have been and go beyond. So thank you again.
The Power of Attorney is produced by Rutgers Law School. With 2 locations minutes from Philadelphia and New York City, Rutgers Law offers the prestige and reputation of a large, nationally known university with a personal, small campus experience. Learn more by visiting law.rutgers.edu.